whether it be mining or whatever else, I wouldn't be surprised if they have, you know, some port investment or whatever. I mean, that, don't hold me to that. That needs to be investigated, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's something behind the scenes, all the dirty money laundering that goes through this province that's driving our real estate markets up and has been investigated over the past several years in terms of the gambling and the casinos and stuff like that. Yeah, no, they're hanging on to power as long as they can here. A typical NDP, you know.
How big is the Asian influence, would you say, in the Lower Mainland real estate market? Like,
okay, so first off, I'm going to qualify that and say, just, you know, on a purely geographic basis, we're going to have a higher percentage of Asian people. That doesn't mean they want anything to do with that. We had, back in the 90s, a whole shit ton of people from Hong Kong who literally fled there to come here to escape what they thought was going to happen, you know, once Britain gave it up. So, I mean, there's a lot of Asian people here that are as, you know, libertarian as any Canadian, right? So trying to pin it down as an Asian thing, I don't know if that's right. But in terms of, like, you know, the CCP, Chinese Communist Party influence, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to qualify, but if somebody took a walk around Simon Fraser University in the late 90s and then took a walk around there today and was to done the, I don't know, Freedom of Information Act requests on where you know, funding to the university goes to, same thing with UBC, I think one would have seen some noticeable changes, both in terms of demographics and financial sourcing. Again, don't hold me to that, can't nail it down to the wall, but you know, let's just say I have a feeling it's more than just a suspicion.
So now I have another question for you. What about the drug laundering and the drug gang war that's taking place in the streets of the Lower Mainland? Would you say that has any influence on the economy that's taking place? I mean, that would be a huge influence.
Well, we do have, we can only look at these things on a per capita basis, but we have the biggest fentanyl crisis in probably all of North America. And the fact that we have looser port restrictions than, say, do the United States, and given that our primary ports to the sources of fentanyl are along the West Coast, I think that leads to a preponderance of coordination between, you know, external exporters of such projects and domestic importers. Doesn't necessarily have to travel as far across the country to reach a destination point of consumers, which I think, yeah, that definitely feeds into part of the problem here that we have in BC. I don't think the fentanyl crisis that we have in BC is on a similar par to, say, the fentanyl crisis you have in the deindustrialized Midwest of the United States. We have a much more robust economy here. We haven't experienced the same degree of deindustrialization since the 80s and 90s, and our physicians don't play as fast and loose as was the case in the United States up until a few years ago, whereby, you know, drug companies can bribe doctors and shit like that. So it's more of a, whereas I think a lot of the opiate crisis in the States was definitely doctor driven, and economic incentive. The crisis here in BC is definitely a lot more to do with where the ports are located.
Do you think that the fentanyl crisis, we have a fentanyl crisis in Alberta too. We have a high opium crisis and depression and suicide rate. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's been compounded greatly by the restrictions that have been plaguing our country?
Well, I think Alberta's had some extra type of restrictions that we typically don't have in BC. I mean, they do impact on BC to a degree, but you know, the federal, shall we say, attempts to nail the coffin shut on the energy industry is going to naturally affect Alberta and deindustrialize Alberta far greater than it is going to in BC. Yes, we do have a bit of an oil and gas up in northeastern BC, which is, you know, the other side of the Rockies, close to northern Alberta, where all you guys have it all, right? So, yeah. You know, it's not like we got, like, we're you know, pumping oil here in the middle of Burnaby or, you know, right next to Vancouver. It's not like that. So the proportion of our industry that is dependent on the energy sector here is far, far smaller. So again, I would say part of the fentanyl crisis you probably have in Alberta has to do with deindustrialization and a direct attack by the second Trudeau administration upon the Albertan energy sector. I mean, the first one is about socializing it. The second one was about shutting her down, right? I think that feeds into more kind of like the depression that tends to, and psychological traumas that tend to accommodate and or not accommodate, but tend to accompany deindustrializing, as we have seen in the Midwest United States.
For my listeners who are listening into this and who will listen to the future recordings, because this will be recorded and dropped, you've gone to school for a few years, have you not? Like, you've taken some courses.
Did a bit of time. I did some time. I did some time in social justice warrior fucking hellscape prison. Yeah.
What did you end up with?
Well, I ended up doing, you know, this is where I don't want to get, like, because it was a rather unique combination that most people didn't do, but I ended up basically kind of specializing in a focus on labor markets, technology, and the future of the workplace, and, community economic development strategies aimed at building local labor market resilience.
So, in other words,
I gave a shit about the working class, not like these globalist fucks. Although I did rather quite well in my global political economy courses. So I was able to connect the big picture to the local.
So when you went to school, you got educated in basically what is taking place right now, how it affects the working class, how the digital implementation by the upper class on the working class will affect it. And how,
yes, and despite being like an honor roll student, based on my choices of research projects and the stuff that I got involved in, it was a set, you know, unless I wanted to, like, you know, leave the area, leave my family and everybody I cared about, and whore myself around the academic labor market for postgraduate work, and you know, master's, PhD, and stuff like that. If I wanted to stay local, which I did, family health reasons, things like that, I was kind of a little too on the radar for not being compatible, shall we say, with, I mean, listen, I pissed off even the, you know, the labor federations and some of the upper union brass type folks, let alone the, I will call them the non-profit industrial complex. Yeah, but I was an activist in a weird way, because on the one hand, people would hear me at first and be like, oh, you know, you care about the working class, you've got a perspective on the environment, oh, you must be very left-wing. And then I'd actually deliver my points and say, well, it's not quite so simple. It's not a left or right thing. This is about human rights and sustaining families and keeping an economy going, and not just applying the hyper simplicity of, like, the black and white, pardon the pun, critical race theory shit, where it's just like, you know, white is wrong and men are wrong and straight is wrong, and, you know, and having to toe that ideology. To me, it was just like, no, all that cultural crap is irrelevant to my perspective. The political economy is what interests me. But what I think a lot of people don't realize, and this is where I think we're living in a, you know, in the last year or so, there's been an awakening, but in the previous decade to a decade and a half, there has been a very big confusion amongst people, because what we had traditionally thought of as this is left and this is right have become a giant shit mix that is in the midst of being sorted out.
It doesn't really exist anymore, does it, in today's world? Like, it's not left and right, bounce back and forth, and they basically, well, just follow the money.
Yes and no, but I think really when you look at what really screwed things up was what became known as the new left versus the new right, where, and that was, you know, the 60s through up until a decade ago or 15 years ago, you know, the traditional left was working class. Working class was never like especially huge on cultural issues. It was, you know, what's the dollars in my pocket? Can I feed my family? Do I have to work 16 hours a day to not be homeless? You know, all the stuff that built us, working rights, all the sort of stuff that allowed us to get voting and democratic rights, all the stuff that allowed civil rights and transfer of property from, like, you know, like for women, for even example, like, you know, the old classical civil rights, working class rights, that's all old left. The so-called new left was what emerged after the civil rights movement, when people of color got civil and democratic rights, and gradually through, we'll call it academic gymnastics, ideas began to get generated, whereby all of a sudden culture became the issue. And so it became more, and then it became not just culture became the issue, but then cultural competition. And that's where we talk about the oppression Olympics, where it's like, okay, it doesn't matter if you're a worker so much anymore. Do you know what washroom to use? You know, how dark is your skin? Right. You know, you know, what country did you come from and how recently did you come there? Right. Oh, you know, are you fully non-white or are you half breed and therefore on the oppressor side of things? Like, you know, like all these sorts of things. And it just became this, instead of having kind of like an understanding of like oppression based upon exploitation of people's material deprivation and desperation, it became one based upon how can we chop you up into these binary categories of race and gender and sex and sexual orientation and approach towards, you know, environmentalism. Like, oh, you know, do you want to have a steak once in a while, or are you, you know, vegan? And literally binarizing people in these ways and chop. And on the one hand, that's why if you look at like the extreme left, they're a circular firing squad. They can, nobody there is, you know, anti-oppressive enough. And so they're constantly like shooting each other in the foot over it, but they still have kind of a sense of unity that goes, oh, well, as much as we, you know, can't figure out who's like the least oppressive and therefore, or the most oppressed person and therefore our God, we're gonna look at anybody who has like any particular number of details, like, oh, a straight white male or whatever else, or oh, you're Christian, and make sure that they're our enemy. Because, you know, yeah, historically, look in North America, white Christian people of various stripes, whether it be Catholic, whether it be Eastern Orthodox, whether it be Protestant of some variety, became the population majority at some point in the last several hundred years. However, it was only in the last 100 years or so where the entirety of the working class was able to even vote. People don't realize that in perspective. People think like, oh yeah, white people came here and conquered. It's like, well, most of them were actually existing under the master and servant legislation. Yeah.
And it was nothing like it is today, right? Like the labor class had to fight for those rights through workers' rights and workers' strikes. And the workers' strikes, when the workers were striking for those rights, was violent. And the rights that the government passed in labor law, a lot of people think it was just the government willing to give it to us, but it was actually to stop the labor movement and the working class.
Part of the labor movement, the other part of it even was, it was something as simple as lawsuits, because we did have something as basic as contract law. And it was like even the general principles of 19th century liberal democracy had a huge effect, in the sense that, like, you know, if you take it before a judge and you, because there's a time in which unions were completely outlawed, like that was a conspiracy, you know, it was a criminal act. Eventually it got bought before judges, and it was basically said, well, if you can have rich people combining joint stock corporations.
Now, if you were looking at what has taken place in the last 2 years, and you look at how they've divided the population, and
hey, bro, hold on. Are you hearing the feedback in the system?
No. Are they doing that?
Are you hearing a third voice?
Not yet. Are you? I'm sure they are, man.
Hold on. No, wait. Hold on.
It's probably you freaking out.
No. You know what it was? My fucking cheek and my phone hit a button for some shit on YouTube. So my apologies if anybody got like a little bit of kerfuffled in terms of what they were hearing. My fat fucking face hit the wrong fucking button, and next thing you know, but yeah. So okay, so please go back to where you're going with that.
So basically, if we were to look at the last 2 years, and we were to look at the extreme transfer of wealth, right? So historically speaking, and it is about the working class, and then you mentioned how in the last 100 years we've gotten voting rights, we've gotten labor rights, or the right to organize a union, which they've slowly taken it away through workers' legislation.
Well, it was a lot more done. Everything that's been given to us, and it's not that we were given to us, it was we fought for and won, has been taken away by stealth. And one actually has to go back, at least here in Canada, to World War II. Well, even to a certain degree in World War I, but World War II most explicitly. And that is the foundation of our labor relations program, which guides the relationship between workers and ownership management, is that, you know, you are not allowed to strike until a collective agreement has expired and all measures have been exhausted of reconciliation and reaching a new deal. Only then are you allowed to strike, and only unions are allowed to strike. Whereas in the United States, where you have more freedom, you know, anybody can go on strike. In Canada, if you're a non-unionized worker, or if you are a unionized worker, but you haven't waited until negotiations at the end of a collective agreement have broken down, you have no right to go on strike. Then there was the whole RAND formula. I mean, I'm not going to get into too in-depth with it, but like, these were all measures that were put in place in the 1940s to ensure a degree of industrial peace and industrial production under a state of emergency. One of the presentations I used to give was, I used to be a guest lecturer up at SFU in the labor studies program. And I did this probably about 6 or 7 semesters in a row. I would do a presentation to basically compare how it was that the labor code as we know it is essentially a carbon copy with different words of war measures, like or were created by war measures and are effect a similar copy to free freedom eras. If you go back to like the master and servant legislation, you weren't allowed to, for example, quit a job. If you were the worker, you weren't allowed to, under master servant legislation, you weren't allowed to quit a job before the end of the contract, which was either determined by a date, like a temporal date, or by a completion of a particular set of tasks. If things got, you know, terrible between you and the employer, you couldn't quit. If so, you would be subject to fines, prison, potentially beatings, right? Well, I mean, what do we see with the development of labor legislation in Canada? It's similar sorts of measures, only if you strike before the completion of your collective bargaining, okay, well, you can be fined. The labor leader is, you know, in contempt of the system. They can be charged with like seditious conspiracy. It's basically master and servant legislation, repackaged into 20th century legislation. Same mechanisms of social control and exploitation, but with more modern, terminological frameworks. It's just repackaging.
So now here we are.
I'm just going to finish. And that's the unionized workers who actually tend to have it better. If you're non-unionized, fuck it. You know, you want to resist, you want to fight, you want to fuck, get out of here. You're on your own. You might be lucky enough to get like, depending on the circumstance, construction, they're known for this, but depending on the circumstance, you might not even get no severance or nothing. Right, yeah. But you sure as hell can't go on strike. You're done. You got no recourse. So, whereas in the United States, anybody can go on strike.
And the Employment Standards Act is usually
a joke. Yeah. Oh yeah, it's the bare floor. Now, don't get me wrong. Technically, a collective agreement could theoretically have a condition or one or another condition that could actually be bargained. And I don't press me on an example off the top of my head. It's been a few years since I gave this lecture, but technically, a union collective agreement could bargain below the employment standards. Very rare, very unlikely, but technically possible. But yeah, regardless, if you're under Employment Standards Act, I'll give you an interesting tidbit of history. It wasn't until 1991 that in the province of Ontario, they finally officially changed the name of employment law from the Master and Servants Law to Employment Standards Act. 1991, like in our lifetimes. Dude, I think that was when we started high school and I met you. So I've known you about as long as the last Master and Servant legislation was in existence in Canada. And technically on ships, if you're on a ship out to sea, the Master and Servant law is still in certain circumstances how it operates.
So how would you say that, based on the regulations that we have today and the fact that, so in Alberta, Jason Kenney has said, yeah, we're removing the REP program, which is the restricted REP program, which is the Vax passport and stuff. But what he's not saying, and what is lost a lot of people, and I'm sure the same as Steve, is that, I'll just mute you while I ask this, and then I'll bring it, and then I'll unmute you, Joe. Is that in Alberta, it was the corporations that were enforcing it. So like it wasn't so much AHS, it was the Costco that would phone, you know.
It's people. The privatization of medical tyranny.
100%. 100%.
Okay. Now, best I can kind of do a comparison. BC, again, a little bit different. One thing I will just point out quickly, and then I'll let you finish. In Saskatchewan, at the same time as Twat Schmo, the premier, was announcing everything was going to be disbanded, he'd already had up on the government white website, they were taking tenders for bids from private companies on setting up a individual person digital ID program. So and secondly, I need to go back and check my sources, but to the best of my understanding, part of the reason some of the provincial governments are dropping it, particularly the more, shall we call them, nominally conservative ones, is that because Le Petit Tard has basically got a federal system being planned under the pretext of Canadians leaving the country and going elsewhere, but he's got a federal system plan which will allow for interprovincial travel, blah 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 blah, right? And so the conservative premiers who are wanting to say appear to be like, you know, we'll call them progressive and get out in front of this and drop shit, they know doesn't matter. Fucking Tardo is gonna go and implement it on a federal level anyways. So it's, you know, okay, they might be a couple months ahead of the curve, and it helps them then sell the future provincial election as saying like, hey, you know, we went to drop it. It was the federal government did this. Blame the Liberals, right? Meanwhile, they're still in cahoots. They know what's coming down the pipe. They're just not playing along because they know what's going to happen.
It was really important that when Kenny dropped it, WestJet never dropped theirs, Air Canada never dropped theirs, the federal entry points never dropped theirs, the cruise lines never dropped theirs, the no federal borders never ever dropped theirs. And that's what the whole Tucker convoy mandate was, right? And in reality,
you know, and I know, and most people should know that digital ID is being rolled out across Canada, right?
Yeah, so that's social credit. That's the social credit system. Did you get the thing I sent you earlier with that dickwad from the Canadian Banking Association? Who is like, the video of the guy from, and giving a little audio hand job to the World Economic Forum in the process of it. Yeah, that fucking goof.
Live and uncut with Joe.
I got can fucking suck.
So
a fountain,
I have a question
man.
For you. So you were involved in heavy activism when you were younger, right? You did
much
some
younger,
like
much younger.
Take I over MLA offices. You
premier offices actually. I shut down the legislature. I did a few things, but I mean again, this was in like the height of anti-globalization era.
What did you do in the office at the height of anti? Like that's what people don't understand. See, here's the problem, and I think a lot of people don't understand is me and you. We stood on the steps of the Vancouver Art Gallery and we protested against the Security Prosperity Party.
That was the NAU in 07, 08. Yeah. Okay. Right? When I'm talking about this. This was
when you were in university and you were.
This was right around the time that you and wife, you were staying with me and that fucking sellout. Anyway, it's not around that, give or take a year. But what ended up happening was, we knew at the time that, Campbell had just gotten elected as premier. And we knew, it was a student thing. So obviously we knew he was like going to deregulate tuition. But also there was like a lot of other like really hardcore neoliberal shit coming down the pipe that was basically just gonna gut. And this is where I talk about like the left and right being kind of mixed up on shit right now, is because a lot of people don't realize, say when Trump said "Make America Great Again," and I think that was a great slogan because what it captured was a pre-limp neoliberal era wherein you could have conservative family values, but they did also have a national-based economic structure and a degree of social welfare, and a degree of social welfare program. So like, if you get on, you lose your job, you got some unemployment, whatever else, right? There was a social safety net historically that was allowed and enabled the support of a nuclear family. As things began shifting in the 70s, and then under Reagan and Mulroney and Thatcher and blah, 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 and things, what ended up happening was you ended up with a more neoliberal system wherein the economics became very, like, extreme libertarian to the point that it didn't provide the social safety network that would support the nuclear family in times of trouble.
Well, you have corporations paying less taxes than you do working.
And not only that, you push women into the workforce and tell them that's their basis of freedom, and now they want to make money rather than being a housewife, and then they're trying to, and then they're more interested in how they can employ a Filipino nanny to look after their kids than they are in being a mother, right? Because they look at what the end economic result is and wonder why their kids are so fucked up. So
and that's based on studies done by John Hopkins by the Rockefeller.
Oh, those are studies done all over the world over the last 50 fucking years. Like this isn't like this is a politically incorrect thing to say, but it is a factual thing to say, right? And so it is what it is. Like, you know what? There was a degree to which the post World War II Keynesian welfare state was so good at promoting a nuclear family. Until the Nixon shock when they went off the gold standard in the 70s, everything was just a fucking slow collapse, and it's been nothing but trying to put out a crisis by doing things that are just setting up the next crisis for the last 50 years ever since. So again, that's getting too complex here, that I'm sure your listeners don't want to listen to all that. It would take too long anyways, but point being is, if we go too libertarian on the economics, we end up lacking the kind of social foundation that is needed for a strong nuclear family when they're going through those transitional periods and times of trouble, and having a, you know, single family earner that is able to capably provide. And so as a consequence, we end up all that much more alienated. All more of us end up in fucking apartments. Our parents split up, all more fucked up, right? And with economic angst and everything else. There was something to be said about having a nationalistic based economic system where, you know, you're doing, you know, your priority is to produce and consume stuff within your own, you know, polity, combined with, I won't call it socialist, but a degree of a social safety network, so that those who are transitioning between this job and that job, or moving state or province to that province or state or whatever else, had, you know, had a little bit of something to, you know, kind of keep them going, but they weren't, you know, they weren't pushing this extreme kind of cultural libertarianism where it's like, you know, feminists and trannies and blah blah blah, right? To just, you know, like everything is completely alienated and hyper individualized on a cultural level. Because if you look back in that era, people were still going to church on Sundays, right? Businesses weren't open on Sundays. You went to church on Sundays and you spent time with the family, you'd have family dinners, you'd do blah blah blah, whatever, right?
Yeah.
You know, but with the advent of globalization, which coincided with the Nixon shock and the end of the gold standard, because now there was no longer restrictions at the national level on the flows of capital across borders, it set the stage for the globalization of production and the shifting of jobs to China. And the gradual erosion of the economic base. Yeah, and so now that's already done. I mean, one of the things Trump did try and do, and I can't say I'm like a huge Trump or nothing, but I mean, the one thing he did try and do was restructure a few things in order to bring jobs a little bit back. Canada, you know, we haven't tried to do that. If anything, we've tried to do the opposite and keep worsening the situation rather than trying to, you know, our government, we'll call it, is they're more interested in trying to build back better, but that's because they're all World Economic Forum lackeys who are more interested in kickbacks that are bigger.
Oh, and huge, that's bribe. Huge bribes.
So I have a question. So, so when you, the at the time that you did the, and I just want to bring up the activism, because you guys were aggressive.
You going 20 years ago, but yeah, absolutely, go for it.
And what did you accomplish anything? Like,
dude, at this point, we were students. The most, I mean, like, we were just a bunch of ragtag fucking 20-year-old, 21-year-old, 22-year-old students who were just trying to raise an issue about shit. And the problem was, keep in mind, I was also, shall we say, to a certain degree, structurally confined, and then still learning a lot as I go. Because, I mean, shit, man, how many of us really know fuck all about the world when we're 20 years old? We really don't. I mean, you're getting exposed to ideas, and I think that's one of the problems we have with a lot of students, is that basically they're white belts in life who are being exposed to black belt concepts, and they just end up injuring people because they don't know how to apply them. And so, I don't want to get like toot my own horn too much. I mean, I still had so much more to learn over the years, but one of the biggest things that, I was still at odds with most of the people I was working with, precisely because, you know, they were wanting to turn for example, when we were occupying Campbell's office, they were wanting to turn what was a tuition fee issue and something just affects the working class across the boards, and instead trying to like have people get up there and start shouting about like, oh, well, it's that much worse for people of color and all this group and that plug and the BIPOC and the this and that and blah, blah, blah. And, oh, you know, how bad this is on queer students or whatever else. And it's just like, dude, you're going to keep a bigger coalition if we don't chop things up into identity issues, right? Like, that's the way I've always looked at it, is look at the ruling class and look at the rest of us. You know, nobody would go hungry if we didn't have billionaires and we, you know, we basically capped them at a certain amount of like extraordinary wealth that no one else would ever be able to accomplish anyways. We're basically capped them a certain amount of wealth and say, hey, yeah, you want to keep going on and doing this as kind of like a, you know, like a sport, you know, and get more involved in your business. Sure, fine. But like, you know, the wealth you accumulate after a certain point goes to make sure that people aren't going fucking hungry and everyone can get a fucking education, whether it be in trades, whether it be academic. Well, I know.
Tax reform and money laundering reform,
remove the ability to do offshore crooked shit like the Panama Papers are proving, right? Take all those funds and wipe out everybody's fucking mortgage debt. You know, because if we've all worked hard enough for our shit, take students and go, okay, well, you got pushed by your school counselors to go and do this. Yeah, it didn't work out for you. Whatever. You know what? There's trillions of dollars in the Panama funds and all these illegal, like, why do we need to keep maintaining these trust funds for people who already have more than they'll ever need and the rest of their generations will ever need? Why do we need to do that?
They can spend
because that gives us incentive. No, it doesn't. It keeps us fucking. It keeps more of us wanting to, you know, just giving up on life because things have become such a bigger grind. I just don't look at billionaires and think of that as a fucking societal necessity. You know, I mean, you get a class of people that is so few in number, but has such a tremendous lot of wealth. We don't that they're able to create corrupt political institutions. You can't have a functional political democracy without the vast majority of the population being an independent working middle class. Whether it be small business owners, whether it be, you know, respectfully paid employees, that when you start gutting that middle class and turning everybody but the 1% into a bunch of fucking serfs and maybe another percent of them into the police that keeps the serfs in line, you know, you're not getting the type of incentive that you need to have a increasingly improving society. You end up with fucking feudalism again. Only difference is on a global scale. Yeah, only difference is on a global scale rather than, you know, a subnational fucking principality scale.
So I think part of the problem, and maybe you can add your input in this. I think part of the problem is that when people look at it, one, we're so distracted, right? It's the YouTube generation. It's 10, or I would actually say it's the TikTok generation. It's 10-second clips or less. But two, the what's taking place with COVID and the digital ID and the digital control system, it's such a vast, vast apparatus and a vast mechanism of control that most people are looking at it and they feel
helpless. Absolutely. Right? Because you know what, and let's be honest, in a lot of ways, other than our sheer numbers, we are. If we look at the structure and, you know, to be totally honest, the billionaire class knows about the technology that's being developed and the pace at which it's being developed with and the rate at which they, at least at their level, can be, you know, adopted. I mean, we didn't have like multi-gig level computer processors until like the late 90s, early 2000s. They had them 10, 15 years before. So the level of technological sophistication and control that they have and their ability to, shall we say, manage the pace of technological development that the random population can access, they've got control over that. So in terms of saying, hey, yeah, we've got, you know, this freedom of, you know, information sharing on computer, yeah, by the time we've got freedom of information sharing on computers, they're already developing ways in which they can like filter that out, track and trace who we are, you know, and slowly begin, you know, ways and means of, you know, repressing that. Like,
what's they're doing right now with CLA?
They're so far ahead of us in terms of what they have access to on the and the ways and means they have to control us You know, and so that's what I mean. It's like, we got to take that factor into consideration. So yeah, a lot of people feel hopeless, not necessarily because they understand the technological apparatus on a, you know, on a sophisticated level, but just simply that, like, oh, if I don't take the jab, I don't have a job. It just needs to be something that fucking black and white and simple as fuck. It's like, okay, either I take a risk of having myocarditis and, you know, VADs or whatever, or I can't feed my kids. You know, and you know, let's be honest, the majority of the population aren't sophisticated intellectuals, let alone sophisticated intellectuals that have a critical perspective on the world or the information base, or have taken the time to develop that information base in order to become critical, critical perspective on things. You know, so we're a rare breed, my friend. And so when you think about that being the majority of the population, great way. George Carlin said it best. He said this, he said, you know, think of how stupid the average person is, and then realize that half of the people are stupider than that. Right? Like, that's, I mean, that really fucking nails it down. And that's why it's such an uphill battle. It's not that, like, you know, folks like us in this conversation can't figure it out and want to do something about it. It's that we're fucking literally being dragged down into the fucking depths of the Marianas Trench by all the dumb motherfuckers on this planet. And the funny thing is, it's those dumb motherfuckers that the ruling class is trying to elevate and sink us with, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, I can, like I said, I can go, keep going on, but
if anyone wants to ask any questions, feel free to put your hand up and we'll take questions and stuff.
It's definitely turned into more than the 15 minutes that I said I'd have with you, but that's okay. I'll take a few questions.
I just wanted somebody with background in class labor to speak, who has an understanding of social, like, of social awareness, who's also an activist, because I feel like a lot of people are looking at the convoy and oh yeah, here's, we got a question. Go ahead, AD. You're free to speak.
How you doing, guys?
Good. You?
Yeah, not shabby.
Cool. Sorry, I'm a little out of breath. I'm at the gym right now, but I'm listening. I want to speak to what you said about the TikTok generation, how they how they can only handle about a 30-second video or less, and just how true that is. So my question is, what is it going to take to reverse that? Because, like, it's not even just the young kids. I see this in some of my own friends, and these guys are pushing 40. And it's amazing how these phones and the smart technology can take over their lives. But even how in denial they are about it when you call them out on it. You know,
convincing, like, around people to learn to read again. Make reading great again. There's a hat for you. Make reading great again.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to.
Because, like, honestly, like, how many books, just between the two of you guys, how many books have you read in the last year? Personally, I've read about 3.
Well, I mean, I guess if you add up, like, news articles and, you know, academic articles and different things like that, it's like, I mean, again, I'm probably atypical. But, yeah, I mean, and if you were to ask yourself, of those 3 books, how many of them were, say, you know, reading Klaus Schwab's book on COVID-19 and the Great Reset versus how many of those three books was about, like, okay, a Jack Reacher novel or some shit. You know what I mean? Like,
it's, yeah, that's my point, right? Because I was just going to say, I read The Great Reset just because when I first heard about it, someone sent me a PDF. I just wanted to read it. I don't know if you guys have actually read it, but, like, it is fucking crazy, man. Like, it's if you've never read it, to anyone listening, do yourself a favor and get a PDF. They're floating around on Telegram. Read this book. It is fucking insane what these
explicit people, it tells you what they're doing.
Yeah, and it's like they don't even pull any punches. They call us useless eaters, amongst other things. It's absolutely ridiculous. But I think you guys hit the nail on the head there, where people need to start reading again. Because, yeah,
well, you just nailed it right there. You just nailed it right there when you talk about Klaus Schwab and the useless eaters. I'm going to bring this back to you know, it's, I wouldn't even want to submit it because the editing was so shitty on it. But it was like the last academic paper I ever wrote, and I wrote it when I was fucking drunk. But it was, just because I was so depressed while I was fucking writing it. But basically, what it was like, it was an argument about, okay, Karl Marx had what he called the relative surplus population, which was, after a certain point in the development of capitalist society, you end up with like an excess population.
Oh, they don't want you to talk about that.
Oh, that was a little bit too much truth.
Oh, they're on to us. Uh-oh. Like, wait, you're talking about Marx? Shut him up.
These fucking guys, man. These Canadians.
Oh, wait, they're actually just trying to talk about truth? No, they're being honest with people? Whoa, we better shut them up.
Oh, shit.
Like, here's the thing, is that it's an honest conversation, so whoever's listening, enjoy it, fucking. I guess Joel left. The bottom line, what he was talking about is if you look at Karl Marx and he talks about capitalism, he talks about a certain point, they cut his shit off, at a certain point where you have an excess population that is not meeting the demands of society. Okay. And anybody can read it. I actually posted the PDF. I can go back and post it. So I'll have him on back again. I guess he cut his phone off or Telegram cut him off or whatever. I just wanted to bring him on to for people that to just get an understanding of like the history of the class and the labor structure. And he's going to be a guest going forward, and we'll take more questions and stuff like that. And yeah, that's interesting shit. They cut him off.
Good times. I saw he just joined again. I don't know if he's I thought I saw him just join again, but yeah, it was interesting.
Oh, he's back. You back? You gotta open your mic, Joel. He'll be able to explain it. I mean, I've read some Marx and stuff, but I don't have the background or the education.
Same. Yeah, I've read a little bit here and there, but I can't stomach to read any of that communist crap. Like, you know, it's insane to me the level of infiltration too, just in our society. I work at a local job site workwear company, right? So I sell work clothes to oil and rig guys. And two of the girls that work there on my weekends, one of them is a close friend, family friend of Rachel Notley. And I've seen her show me pictures of Notley hugging her kids and shit. And, you know, you just kind of smile and nod your way through that. But she's openly socialist, very much openly socialist. She is a Caucasian of herself, but she is right in there with white people are the worst, that were the cause of all the death and suffering in the world. She's right up, right down. It's fucking crazy. But the other one, the 19-year-old, she is straight full-blown communist. Like, she attends communist meetings where they discuss the works of Karl Marx. And what blew my mind was the fact that something like this is a thing that exists in my city. I'm from Edmonton myself, so we actually have communist community here in this, and it just makes me wonder how much it's grown and how big it actually is, because it really only seems to be appealing to the kids, right?
Now, I'm going to jump in on this, if you don't mind my asking. I'm going to jump in on this. Okay, so. And again, this comes back to my earlier discussion of between what the, you know, original or old left was and what the, you know, contemporary or new left is. Old left had to do with working class standards of living, workplace safety, being able to provide for the family, all that sort of stuff. The quote unquote new left is what began after the 60s, which was much more about cultural stuff like gender and race and all that shit that just makes us want to fucking puke every day when we see it on fucking line, right? Mm-hmm. Or we see it in our schools, or our children are subjected to it in their classrooms, right? That's a different story. I mean, you go back to traditional old school leftism, which in a sense is what original Marx was about. It wasn't racially based. It wasn't gender based. It basically said, you know, it was about the working class. You know, you work hard, you deserve to be able to provide for your family, and not in a barely scraping by way. You know, you deserve the opportunity to build up and have the opportunity for upwards mobility. That was kind of like, and the propaganda that has been developed over the last 100 years or so has really misled people along that. Not to say that, you know, I sit there and abide by this or abide by that, but at least as an intellectually honest person who's taken his time to study this shit, I know the difference between, you know, what, say, for example, you know, kind of the more classical red shit was versus kind of like how it's become and what it's evolved into in the last 30, 40, 50 years. In the last 30, 40, 50 years, it's become about destroying the family. Prior to that, it was about how can the man have the ability to provide for his family so that the family isn't subjugated into, you know, grotesque labor situations and exploitation. You know, how do we fight hard for our loved ones? You know, that was really what it was all about. And it morphed. And so I think in a lot of cases, and that's why I said, you know, way earlier in the conversation, the whole notion of left and right has gotten so distorted. I don't even like using that anymore. I like using, you know, the definition of, like, you know, opportunities for self-improvement or opportunities for, you know, getting, you know, upward mobility and, you know, equality of opportunity, making sure everyone has the chance that if they're willing to put in a little bit of effort and try, they have a chance to improve their lot and make sure their family might have a better chance in the world than they did as a kid, right? That's really kind of what it should be about. Nobody's saying, like, oh, well, we got to, like, level off everything and make sure that, like, you know, and this is where I look at the World Economic Forum and they say, oh, we'll own nothing and we'll be happy. It's like, yeah, except for the fucking billionaires who own everything. And the only way that the rest of us are equal is in the fact that we own nothing and the billionaires own everything, you know, and it's about that equality between the classes that they don't want to talk about. That's the shit that they're trying to, like, suppress. And so that's where I kind of look at and go, okay, well, you know, what does Marx actually have us to offer in terms of, like, trying to understand what the system is trying to do? Because, like, Sun Tzu, have you ever heard of Sun Tzu, the Chinese military thinker from Sun Tzu said, it's like, know your enemy, right?
Yeah,
you know, if you don't want, like, you know, like a 1% upper crust to literally own everything, the rest of the 90% just be climbing over each other like a bunch of crabs, you know, but calling that equality, which is the direction we're headed under the World Economic Forum, Club of Rome,
United
Nations.
Warren Buffett, the Berkshire Hathaway or whatever it's called, fame.
Yeah, Berkshire Hathaway, yeah.
Is on record as stating, yes, the class war, we are winning. On record. So what I think, what the main premise is, when you went to school, Joel, was the extreme mark, critical race theory infiltration there, or was it just starting?
Okay, we're going back in the late 90s, early 2000s. You began to see it popping up, but you know where it was popping up was with, you know, younger professors, not ones that had been, like, studying shit for the bulk of their lives and actually understood shit. It was just ones that were like, hey, you know what, I want to pretend that I'm radical and not really have any implications of what this might mean, because, hey, I've got a pretty fucking cushy job that, you know, is going to, especially if I can get tenure, I've got a career track job that doesn't require me to break my back, sweat, do anything hard, you know, whatever, right? Unless they actually want to, right? You know, okay, maybe they'll go and sweat in the fucking yoga class, but that's about it, right? You know, there is a certain thing about academic freedom, but they'll also recognize that their academic freedom is limited by the cultural politics of the institution. But, you know, in 20 years ago, that was it. You go back, I mean, it's been about 5-6 years since I was in there. You go back about 6 years ago, and you started seeing them, and it was just all this constant hammering of gender shit and racial shit and everything else. And that was, I mean, it's gotten even worse now. Like it has literally taken like existential leaps forward in terms of how bad it's gone.
Not saying that that's not a result of that. I mean, you can clearly follow the money. Anybody can follow the money. You can follow the foundational money. It's a clear result of direct investment from the yes. class.
See, I remember I got in trouble back in about 2001 for taking on the president of the university. Basically saying he was selling our, you know, like SFU had this beautiful radical history from the 60s and 70s. And we're, you know, critical. We were kind of like the, you know, one of the outlier institutions. And, the, you know, he was basically selling us down the road for a neoliberal agenda to push globalism. Because, like, you know, whatever. Anyways, I raked him over the coals with that. And, you know, our mutual friend of that era was the first backstabber in trying to take me out on that. But, anyways, you know, what they were trying to do at that time was really push the development of online education such that, oh, you can get a, you know, university degree and never have to show up to class, right? And trying to cultivate, but they wanted to be the forefront in technology. And at the time that this was going on, the vice president of Electronic Arts that makes like so many video games was a VP at the university. So there was like all this corporate influence that not only had to do with how that current president of the university had gotten his job and transferred as a vice president from York to becoming president of SFU. Not only was that like level of like influence involved, because he was even known at York for being the vice president who was trying to like sell out traditional academia to online shit. But what, you know, and so and then, well, yeah, I mean, like, that's what I mean is I'm getting like way off track, but because you're asking questions and it really has to do with some like really kind of like small detail of technical shit. But the point being is the bigger issue was that 20 years ago, we recognized the corporatization, the neoliberalization, the sellout of the university as a public institution that was designed to be, you know, paid for by the public to, you know, inform the public about issues of public interest. And it was then in the process of being transformed into being an institution paid for by corporations to shift the education system towards making people think in ways that were going to be more profitable for global institutions. And that was called neoliberalization.
How do you beat it? how do you reach people?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like, well, yeah, you know what? And I would say, I wish, you know, and here's the thing is because now I'm like a, you know, mid 40s, you know, physically semi broken old man. And say, hey, shit, you know, well, no, I mean, I've had back injuries and I spent too much time in a chair reading and shit and whatever else, right? To sit there and try and transform my whole life into becoming a physiologically fixed tradesman, it's getting, you know, it's getting a little bit challenging. But point being is, I would never encourage any child to go into, you know, post-secondary that isn't anything other than engineering, medical science, or like a trade skill or something. Anything that is remotely liberal arts, keep them the fuck away. Like, because they're just going to get brainwashed in this shit.
You know what I mean? Like, it's really just social skills, right?
Well, it's not even social. I mean, social skills are a part of it because obviously you learn bad social skills if you're in those in the humanities and social sciences departments. It goes beyond that. It goes actually into the fact that many students who will literally go in and take out student loans and then get immersed in that shit and then have literally no useful skill other than being a technocrat that tries to tell people how to think and how to live and what to do with themselves. Now, that is exactly what the World Economic Forum wants. The World Economic Forum and the UN and all these globalist institutions, what they thrive on, they entirely thrive on upon a portion of the lower middle class, upper working class, folks actually like myself who didn't rebel, but those who didn't rebel, who, you know, basically got learned and conditioned to and trained in the education system, but then also got stuck in student loan debt and needing to pay it off, but not having any actual practical skills to pay it off with, that you take that portion of the population, which is a good 10% portion of the fucking, you know, students in the population, and say to them, okay, well, here's where we're going to give you a living and allow you to pay off your debts from school and allow you to apply all that programming, all that brainwashing that we fed you in university, and you're going to become an agent for the United Nations, for the World Economic Forum, for Trudeau, and all this, you know, liberal fucking nonsense.
Which is where we are now.
Vincent, I'm perfectly trained to become an operative for that sort of shit. Yep. I just would rather die. So
Joel, just come on,
Vincent. Hey guys, just had a crazy idea tonight. I don't know, maybe it'll work. So I'm calling it Cash for Freedom 2022. Everybody goes and takes out $100 a day for as many days as it takes until they end the mandates. Just imagine, we know in Ontario alone, 100,000 people donated, right?
Yeah.
Even that's a police, big number. Do the math. Even OPP got busted for donating.
Do the math. And it's not a crime. You just go to the bank, you take $100 out every day. $500
technically
a week. You're not
technically spending. Anything under I'm gonna cut you off, and I know where you're going with this. Technically, they can't report it to Canada Revenue Agency if it's under $10,000. There were people who had been doing the $5,000 thing. I saw this. I'm sorry, I have to go back and hunt it down. There were some people who are doing the $5,000 thing. And then apparently the other day, banks were told no more than $3,000. But it doesn't mean those are all CRA reported. It was just increasing limitations on how much you could take out in order to prevent the system from going into a crisis. Yeah, so because they only got, like, you know, it's a reserve crisis. So point being is that if $10,000 is your CRA reporting limit, if you go in and you find out, well, what's the max in cash I can take out today, go and do it. Begin accumulating as much as you can. Find a bullion exchange. Don't buy gold, buy silver. Gold is actually higher. Silver fluxes a bit, but the difference between silver, especially on a long-term basis, it still rises, but it also does give you a greater degree of day-to-day ability to pay than does gold, just because it is more portable, partable. You know what I mean? Like a little nugget of gold will fucking be, you know, it's hard to fucking chop up and pay groceries with, whereas a couple of silver coins, you're more likely to, right? So, buy silver is one thing. The other thing is buy necessities. You know, go, if you, depending, I don't know where you live, man, but if you got like a East Indian market or whatever, that's the place to go and buy, like, you know, 2-3 40-pound bags of rice, buy like 100 pounds of beans and legumes. Like, that way you've at least got food no matter what the shit happens, right? You know, little things like that. And like, okay, say in the meantime, while you're more flush with cash until shit hits the fan really bad, and you got like, okay, you empty out, say you empty out an example of like a protein shake that's worth like 5 kilograms or whatever. And you got that plastic jug. Don't toss that out. You know, make sure it's nice and dry. Put some rice in that, put some beans in that, things like that. Like, you know, we got to start thinking survival on the one hand, and the other hand, we got to start thinking in terms of community networking, local economic resiliency, bartering, things like that. So if you're like one of those folks, you know, you got like an extra bit of money, yeah, go and buy some like extra 22 shells. You know what I mean? Not because you need them, but because you can trade them. You know, get anything else you can think of and take a room in your house, and that becomes your survival plan. But also got to make sure you got like the capacity to back it up if things hit the fan, right?
I think the question is that he was asking about the $100 for crashing the banks. And what I don't think people understand, and a lot of people don't understand, is that the banks by Canadian law, by federal Canadian banking law, they don't have to have anything on reserve. So like technically when you go into 10%
at most.
What's that?
10% at most.
No, it's zero. I posted it the other day. It's 0%. Cool. I posted the whole act. It's 0%. They changed it. When Harper bailed out the banks, they changed it, and they changed it down to 0%. So they have 0% reserve mandate that they have to have. So the only thing that people need to understand is when we crash the banks, and by pulling our money out of the system, the financial system.
You will
system,
do that for sure.
The message we're sending is to foreign investors. We're taking away the confidence out of our federal banking system to foreign investors, and foreign investors are just going to pull their money out left and right, which they will.
That is exactly what just happened. If you want to know why they just pulled the freeze on stuff, and it's only been the last day or so they've announced it that they're ending the freeze. Not only are they ending the freeze on people, but they're also ending the Full Emergencies Act. I mean,
so, yeah, that,
like, granted, like Freeland said, we're keeping measures. What their measures are, and this is my instinct telling me, is that the measures that Freeland is keeping is the backroom infrastructural channels between the pigs, between the government, between the banks, that if, you know, on a very, you know, hushed up level, the pigs are like, hey, you know what? That guy who owns Patriot Shacks, blah, 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 he's fucking doesn't like Trudeau. And Trudeau's like, oh, well, hey, you know, Canadian Banking Association, they don't like me in the World Economic Forum, fucking them in the ass. Then the banking association pulls your shit, right?
See, for the bank.
And it's, so,
for the bank.
So that's what I mean. It's like, it's just a, I mean, we work construction. Like, the first thing you do is, you know, after you get grade on the, you know, you begin digging out the utilities. What they did last over the last week and a half was build the utilities. They're going to keep using excuse after excuse over the coming years and decades to add to those utilities and eventually take from the underground infrastructure and begin adding a political legal superstructure.
See,
to bring us toward, to, in order to bring us towards a Chinese-style social credit system. Because they didn't already have a full-on dictatorship in place like China did, they can only do it bit by bit. And they pushed as far as they could go to the point that even rich motherfuckers from around the world were looking at this going like, you know what, this shit's gone too far. I want my money out. And so then the government realized, oh, okay, maybe we went a little too far with this, made a little too obvious. So we're going to back off for a bit. But these globalists, they chip away. They go bite by bite, bit by bit. Oh, they got it. If they get punched in the nose, they step back 2 steps and they wait till the bleeding stops and the fucking bruising heals. And then they start coming back again at you in different ways and at different angles. So we can't think that just because this shit ended this fucking day or last day that somehow the problem we're facing and the overall nightmare that's being thrust upon us is going to go away. No, we literally need to understand that, like, no, all we did was stall them for enough to wipe a little blood out of our nose and take a deep breath and get ready to start punching back.
I don't think it was us. I think if you look at it, if you look at how much foreign money was being pulled out of the Canadian banking system and how much of it was foreign.
Canadian citizens got literally saved by the global rich. But we'll only be able to do that for so many times. We cannot. The working class of Canada that doesn't want to be jabbed cannot rely on the global financial elite to keep bailing us out. It was only because Trudeau went a little too far. But in going that far, what he did do was lay the very base levels. He put the shit tube, piping into the system. And they're going to keep trying to build upon that. And before you know it, they're going to have a fucking, a globalist church built on top of that fucking shit pipe they just threw in.
I think they did two things. I think what they did is, one, he laid the foundation for a backdoor entry to monitor all accounts. Yep. And two, the other thing that he did was he laid the groundwork that they can extend it at any point in time. And it's just FinTech regulations that extend.
Well, you know what they originally did? You know what they originally did? It was 21 years ago with anti-terrorist legislation. Is make anybody who disagrees with the government a potential terrorist. Terrorist. And of course, if you have an undefined definition of terrorism that is just literally like anything, then you can qualify anybody as that. So what that did is 20 years ago, you want to talk the real shit pipeline at the very bottom of the excavation. That was the anti-terrorist legislation of 2001. Right, they've added a little bit of dirt onto that, and now they've added the financial. If it doesn't happen in the next 3, 4, 5 years, it'll happen in the next 2, 3, 4 decades, and they're just literally layering on yes, technologically they already have the systems to do it. China's proved it, but what they don't have yet is enough global legitimacy to keep layering up in the next levels of dirt and the next bits of information and the next bits of infrastructure in order to create it in the direction that they want to. So we gotta make sure that we push back at every step. And that's what I keep saying is, like, the most important thing that we can do in terms of a resistance movement is not necessarily just fight against the vax pass, or not just fight against the fact that Trudeau is a fucking retard, or Freeland is her grandpa is a Nazi. We really gotta point to the fact that anybody who has even remotely involved with the World Economic Forum is involved with a coup d'etat. We got to use that language. Coup d'etat is this is an infiltration of our political order in order to institute and implement and activate a coup d'etat. The reason Canada is kind of at the forefront of this globalist coup d'etat movement is because the only country that can compare to us on a population versus resource kind of relative scale is Australia, but they've been going so hard for so long, and there wasn't the same level of effective pushback, and that probably has to do with the juridical structure in Australia, but I'm not an expert on that. But Canada is, one can always, the rest of the world can always look and be like, Australia, they're a prison colony, and so they've got obviously a lot of bad eggs there, right? Whereas Canada has, for the last of 50, 60, 70 years, cultivated his reputation as like the nicest country in the fucking world. So the fact that Trudeau went as hard and as fast and as quick as he did and as dirty as he done against us, it does raise a bit of awareness, but it also goes to show you the willingness to which the global ruling class wants to take us out, because on a per capita, per resource type basis, you know, we're probably even better off than Australia. Even they got a slightly lighter population. And the ratio might be slightly better there, but if they can conquer us, it's then much more sellable for them to go and keep ramming their agenda down the rest of the Western civilization's throats. And so that's why we are kind of, you know, at the apex. We're Canada, and survival of Canada as a democratic country.
You think if we fall, then the rest, it goes to the rest.
Yeah, it's a fucking domino. It's a domino. And what we've happened to have right now is because there's so much dirty money in Canada. And I would say, I mean, what propelled Trudeau to stay in power over the last several years is his continuing blind eye towards dirty money coming into this country. But the minute he starts trying to crack down on working class dirty money, all of a sudden ruling class dirty money starts getting worried and wanting to pull their money out. And then he realizes, oh shit, I can't keep up my charade.
Yeah. Go ahead, Niles. So, you had a question.
Yeah. Have you ever, guys, like, this is a pretty big group here and like-minded people. Do you think that there's value in working together to educate the Canadian population? Like, you know, like everybody all of a sudden goes on the social media, say Facebook, on and some of the fake news outlets, and just post information in a kind, concise way to ultimately to wake up Canadians to what's really going on. Have you ever thought about that?
Joe, do you want to answer that?
My personal instinct is, if you go on to the stuff that's too mainstream, if you go on a crack book, if you try and, like, you know, oh, I'm going to add my name to the CBC so I can comment on this post and then, like, add something.
CBC you can't comment on.
Okay. I mean, CBC, CTV,
and like mainstream. That right there tells you, right there, you can't go on the mainstream.
No, the government doesn't want. Government doesn't want. Yeah. But other, you know, the rest of the legacy media, like say Global, or whatever, it's like, yeah, you kind of got to sign up, give your name and your email and blah, 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 right? Like, you kind of got to do that before you do that. It's like, they know right away the fact that they're trying to out you is an indicator that they're trying to suppress your thought. It's an indicator that, hey, if they're trying to out you, that the next time Constina Freeland is looking to grab more people under the banking and RCMP situation, that your name might be, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's kind of like, I appreciate where you're going with this. The idea in theory is an ideal. I just think from, if you want to be personally safe yourself, I wouldn't recommend it.
Personally speaking, and historically speaking, what would you say would be the best way to reach the masses? Like, I think we're past the point of reaching people on social media. I think we're at the point where people on social media, they've made up their mind. They've either accepted the science or they're against the science. They've read it and they're like, no, I'm not accepting it, right? And the people that have accepted the science and line up at the jab, they feel two things. They feel remorse for what they've done, or they're doubling down because they had to do it, so why shouldn't you? And I think that's
what we're basically. The scared ones that are like, oh my God, the government is literally like screwing over anybody who doesn't agree with them, so I'm a cowardly piece of shit. I'm just going to cow down and do what I'm told.
Which that falls under the, you know, like the 2 years of oppressive fear-based psychosis that we've all been under. So I did three polls today, which I found was really interesting. And I asked, you know, do people feel isolated? And it was, it was 50-50. If it was 50% isolation, have you lost family and friends? And it was You look at the numbers, and it was 60 to 70%. So we're like, they're running a major psychological drill at the same time that they're killing people, right? I mean, let's be honest, the shot's killing people. So I think so I'd be best to answer that actually for social media and online. And here's the truth. If you want to know the honest truth, unless you're a guy like Joe Rogan, who's got an audience of 60 million, you're not going to reach anyone. The problem with a guy like Joe Rogan is he's being censored by Spotify, and they're taking his shows off the air. Now that's a productive thing.
What I'm saying is like posting on the actual, like for instance, like CTV News, Facebook.
You're just flagging posting. Yourself, man. You're
flagging yourself. Most of the people who follow that shit enough to get to the third, fourth, tenth fucking self-reinforcing ideological bit of propaganda on that page, they're already there, right? Like, you're not going to convince them. They're just social justice warriors of their own variety who want to buy into more people either saying the same thing they are, or they're looking for people who are heretics that they want to hang out and dry. So if you start trying to post too much on mainstream media, you're pretty much setting yourself up for a doxing and cancel culture shit.
It's called Operation Saphir. S-Z-E-P-H-Y-R. Operation Saphir and Operation Pogo. I'm not going to really go into them. Look them up yourselves. Google them. But that's what he's talking about when he's talking about tagging yourself, Operation Secure. You have to ask, why do these people are able to run multi-million-dollar programs, get multi-million-dollar contracts talking about this stuff, and they're still alive? When all the ones that I grew up listening to...
Well, ass, you gave me fucking websites, man. You got to send me that shit later. I want to look into that.
But,
love you, bro.
I love you, too. What social media... When you go on to like CBC, for one, CBC, you can't post on it. And so on Global and CTV and stuff like that, when you go on them, it's the same thing. They're modified and they're algorithm controlled. And it's almost guaranteed that your comment is behind a firewall. Now, as you're trying to talk about going on to people's accounts and then like interacting with them. So if you go on Twitter, you have a percentage that's bots, you have a percentage that's paid supporters, and then you have a percentage that are diehard, they've doubled down. And then you have all the rest of us who would have been on Twitter, but we've been booted off. So it's an echo chamber from the left. If you go on Facebook and you go look at Jason Kenney or Rachel Notley or any of their posts, they're getting ripped. But the question is, like Joel says, is how many of those people, when it comes down to it, what is that really going to solve? Because they've been getting ripped for the last 2 years. What they're really afraid of, and is fundamentally that people need to understand historically speaking, and it's the reason why they forbid it, is they're afraid of people getting getter on a personal level, because you have more interaction. Like when you're dealing with comments on a social media thing, it's one thing to type something down, and that can be misconstrued. The perception of it could be taken the wrong way. People don't really want to take the time to look at facts. But they've isolated us, and they've made us divided against their loved ones, our families, and friends. And they've done that for a reason. And that is because, historically speaking, any revolution that's ever started has started that way. It started in the pubs, and it started in the establishments, and it started, you know, in the churches.
Experiencing right now is a revolution, but it's a top-down revolution. It's a top-down revolution that is entirely and empirically designed to look at what are the different branches of civil society and how we can turn them against one another, whether it be on race, whether it be on gender, whether it be on who we want to fuck, whether it be on, like, you know, what our views are on, like, fucking diet, whether it be upon, you know, you pick one, they want to, or whether vaccination, of course, is a huge one, doesn't matter. There, if it's a top-down revolution, and that's what we are literally in, is like, we are in a revolution, But we are foolish to believe that we're in a bottom-up revolution taking on the elites. No, we are in a top-down revolution, literally trying to hold up umbrellas and build archways and different things to try and protect us from the downfall of a top-down revolution that is trying to split us up. We need to bring as many people as we can kind of together on similar bases of unity to say, hey, you know what? Yeah, you know what? I don't necessarily agree with your fucking identity politics, but I think we're all better off under the same umbrella to say that we shouldn't let the billionaires split us against one another. And I don't know, that's just me. I'm gonna shut up now. I'll let that go back, but that was just my little interlude.
But it's true though, because we've allowed them to use class to manipulate us against one another. We've allowed them to use our jobs to manipulate us against one another. We've allowed them to use social functions to manipulate us against one another. And we don't have, and it goes, you can go back to Carl, and you know, you have a whole bunch of good people who are hardworking, honest, and they don't have enough time to sit around to figure out how bad they've been getting fucked. And that's the reality of it. And then when we do sit down and we have discussions like this, there's so many things that we can talk about. And at the end of the day, we've spent 2 years as a society, you know, been isolated, we've been separated, we've been labeled, we've been attacked, we've divided.
Our ass is hurt and not enough people know why.
Yeah, and nobody's pulled their hair and thanked us and told us it was a good time. I think, you know, fundamentally, when it started for me, we pulled our kids, we homeschooled our kids from the start. And I think fundamentally, you know, the biggest thing I have a problem with is how could parents of speech developed kids not see the damage and the delay it was being done? So like, we can talk about social media and how do we reach people on social media en masse. We can't even reach parents to see how their actions are abusing your kids. And I think that's fundamentally, as a society, where we've lost. And we lost in that we've lost what makes us a society. That's my perspective, you know, just for me watching it. And you know,
no, my thing is how we've allowed ourselves to define us as a society that's run. It's not that the society's turned on us and, you know, we let them stomp all over us. I think it's a lack of civic participation because we're all so too exhausted from trying to straight by that, you know, we've allowed a self-serving institutional apparatus to begin telling us, and especially telling our kids, what society is, what society ought to be, how we need to transform everything we do in order to do that, rather than being, you know, and because again, you know, if all of a sudden you go from having a one working parent providing for the family to, you know, two parents and, you know, hope for the best for the kids.
I was just going to say
there's
that.
There's no active time to for families like that to take an active role in their, you know, children's curriculum and understanding what's going on, or parent-teacher association sort of stuff, because everyone's too tired by the time they get home. You know, I'll skip the meeting this time. You know, whereas all of a sudden we're now realizing, like, hey, you know what? There's like this handful of parents, and again, more down in Virginia, other parts of the states, they're saying, like, hey, you know what? We don't want our children to be propagated to with hate speech that's pretending it's about equality, but parading itself around as critical race theory. And it's destroying our societies. It's making our kids fight against one another instead of evolving together and learning to appreciate one another and our differences. Instead, it's just creating hate. And you know, because, you know, say, I don't know, I'll use a BC example. Everything's so fucking expensive to live here. Good luck unless you're rich to be able to find a one-parent income family. You know, who the hell has time to keep up on what kind of dogmatic bullshit is being rammed down our kids' throats and propagated within society?
They don't. They don't. No. And that comes back to the class warfare that you were talking about that took place following World War II.
Absolutely.
About how they changed the labor laws and how, I think it was, you know, Aaron Russell's documentary, Freedom to Fascism, where they talked about how feminism
was
funded by the Rockefellers and how the sole purpose was to fund feminism so that they would have the right to work, to go back to work, so they could have another segment of the population to tax.
One, yeah. Not just to tax, but also, and see, that's the thing, is like it goes beyond tax because it also goes down to the cheapening of labor. If you have, okay, say you've got 100% of the population, 50% men, 50% women. I know it's not exactly that, but I'll just use that as a rough figure. If all of a sudden, I'm forgetting about the labor market that is too young or too old, just typically talking about the 16 to 65 age range, shall we call it that. If all of a sudden you can culturally induce even 30% of that population to jump into the labor force, what is that going to do to wages for everybody? It's going to drop them significantly. Say you got 50 million, then you add another 30 million, you average that out. I mean, it's not going to work out quite like that, but think about it. It's going to substantively decrease the work rate, the wage. Now, all of a sudden, nowadays, you start looking at liberal and the Trudeau, Justin Trudeau and the liberals that are wanting to, like, literally increase our immigration policy by, like, 1-point-something% per annum. What is that going to do to our labor force? It's going to produce cheap labor, which for those of us who are already here, what is that going to do but lower our wages, lower our standards of living, make things every, and it has, I'm like, yeah, okay, I sympathize for other people who want to come here and have a better standard of living, sure. But it shouldn't be my responsibility to lower my standard of living because somebody else wants to fucking show up here, right? That shouldn't be my responsibility. Like, if there was, you know, if they could show up here and whatever else, and it just contributed to, like, more construction, more production, more jobs, but not cut back on whether or not I got to feed my kid steak or feed my kid broccoli, then, yeah, you know what? I might be a little bit more open-minded to it.
You know, well, historically speaking, the wealthy class has always strived.
Been pro-immigration.
And pro-immigration for the sole purpose of driving down wages. And I mean, and then it's actually it's a twofold attack that Canada has faced, in that the amount of money that has been printed causing
inflation.
It's inflation just now. Inflation. But, I mean, it'll be hyperinflation, if not runaway inflation, as it is right now. I mean, the cost of food and meat right now and energy. I don't know. Energy bill.
You starve Canadians into having less kids, and then you import them. There was an interesting phenomenon in what happened in a lot of second world countries in the 70s. You take certain countries in the 70s, second world countries, they had tried to adopt what an academic would call import substitution development, meaning they put restrictions up to exports from advanced countries and cheap labor countries. They put export rates up so that they could then afford to use their local population to produce goods and services and whatever else and keep them competitive with what foreign, more developed countries would export. So they raise the they use tariffs and taxes and shit like that to make their own local industry competitive with foreign competitors, right? That is effectively what the problem is with Canada right now. Is yet technically we actually have a technical basis to be highly competitive with other countries in the world, but because we have a shrinking population, it becomes a little bit more expensive. So instead of, they're obviously not going to like drag people's wages down directly. So instead, what they do is they import population. So what we need in the third world, they had excess population. They just had lack of capital. So they used import substitution to raise the capital and try and become competitive. Eventually, that worked against them, whatever. But for various reasons, usually because they were poorer countries. But what we're looking at for ourselves right now is if we want to maintain wages for as best as we can, for as long as we can, what we need, I would describe, and I've yet to really see it in the academic literature because most academics are dickless fucks who refuse to take a stand for their country. But I would call it import substitution population development. You've begun seeing that in places like Poland, Romania, a couple other countries, Czech Republic, where basically what they say is, no, we're not going to take all this, unlike Germany, we're not going to take this giant surplus of Muslim migrants and let them rape our women and fucking whatever. We're going to be like, no, we're going to control our borders. But instead, because we realize we've had declining population rates, what we're going to do is we're going to decrease taxes on families who have more kids so that we can keep our labor force Polish. We can keep our labor force Czech. We can keep our labor force Romanian.
Did Russia do that as well?
We can maintain and preserve our culture, right? And let's be honest, that has nothing to do with Canadians being white, red, green, yellow, blue, purple, fucking whatever. It has more to do with, encouraging the cultivation of people who believe in, a democratic political system, not people who are brought here out of desperation and they'll just do whatever the fuck they're told. It's about cultivating people here who maintain our traditional values. It has nothing to do with the color of their skin.
Traditionally speaking, and you could look back on history, and you would know more about this than I would, that if you wanted to take over a country and a culture and establish something new, you would attack its foundation and its family base, and you would attack its past, and you would remove the statues of historic value, so it would be
classic example is Rome. Classic example is Rome. Actually got to a point where Rome expanded the point to which, Italians, whether regardless of what class they were in, they eventually would join the Roman Imperial Army and help expand the empire. Problem was, all the men are either dying or out on the perimeters of the empire trying to keep it together, but there wasn't enough men domestically to help, keep the food growing and the economy going, right? And, eventually the ones that were then out on the perimeter of the empire trying to hold the borders, enough of them die, have enough kids to replace them. And the kids that they could replace them don't have the incentive enough to go and expand the empire further. They're just trying to hold the line. So what ends up happening is barbarians slowly conquest. Oh, the Roman military needs more troops, so they start recruiting the barbarians. Eventually the barbarians learn how the system works. And they infiltrate and they take over. And the Roman Empire gradually shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And it gets to the point that, you know, there's nobody with a Latin name left to rule the empire. You know, then you end up with feudalism. But I mean, if we want an example in history, there's one right there.
Sounds like
I'm not saying we have an empire to hold. I mean, we're fucking Canada. We don't really have, like conquests. We don't have empires. I mean, the most we are is just like fucking, the history of a bunch of the displaced peasants who had nowhere else to go that showed up here and gradually bought themselves, worked their asses off to. Yeah, we were displaced peasants from Europe who showed up here. I mean, like, as much as the government wants and even the natives want to promote a narrative that, like, oh, we're all just like conquistadors killing everybody. It's like, no, man. The majority of the people who came here in the first several hundred years were just like literally displaced peasants who had nowhere else to go. And they got shuffled over here and they just tried to do whatever the hell they could to survive. And that's the part of Canadian history that isn't politically correct enough to teach, but is more accurate than what they teach. We were just displaced peasants. We were effectively refugees who had that came from countries that had a colonial administration that was effective enough to conquer the existing people here. But for the most of part, the vast majority of us were just refugees trying to go wherever and like not starve to death. But instead, not only does the government, but of course the conquered people want to sit there and trying to paint all of us with the exact same brush that has no actual understanding of the class basis from whence we came. Most of them are just fucking starving motherfuckers. Like, oh, hey, you want to go and grow some food over here? Okay, yeah. You got some little extra cell over here? Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, if you basically got forced off of your little fucking hut in the middle of whatever country in Europe, and all of a sudden somebody said, hey, yeah, here's like fucking a quarter lot in the middle of Saskatchewan, you're going to take it, and you're going to risk yourself, your wife, your kids, whatever, just to go over there and not end up having to go through what Europe went through 200 years ago. But that doesn't make us any better or worse or less than anybody else. We weren't the ones who fucking sat there and imposed it. We were just funny motherfuckers trying not to starve. And
I think,
you know,
historically speaking, what's not told and discussed in educational classes is the fact that for the most part, there were trading forts that were established. They weren't villages or anything. They were trading forts. So it was land being settled by employees of the Hudson Bay or Rupert clan, right? Like,
yep.
It wasn't
Northwest Company, Hudson's Bay Company. Yeah, man. Yeah. And these were all companies that are tied back to the fucking British government. You think the average peasant that got forced over here had any ties to the British government? Fuck no.
So what do you think?
They're trying out the stuff.
What do you think the crown's role in all this is? Because I find it funny that
was trying to divide us all based upon culture in order to divert attention from the fact that this country ended up as fucked up as it did because of class.
So you would say it's the Laurentian elite that established the country the way it is, the Paul Desmarais and the Power Corporation family and all those people can't talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Or what's their names that got like, you know, nailed for pedophilia and owned Crown Royal? Yeah, the Bronfman's and all those fucking cunts. Yeah, I know, man. Well, like
Bronfman is the financial. I think it's Stephen Bronfman. Is the financial controller of the Federal Liberal Party.
Oh, well, I mean, there is, I mean, I have to go back and find it, but I saw a good video from about maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago that basically showed how one of the Bronfmans ended up becoming like a very actively involved federal liberal and helped cultivate, you know, fucking retardo and everything else right. into it, right? Like, and you know, if they brought retardo in, that you know, what's his name, and Gerald Buttfuck was bending over for the World Economic Forum, and he basically became kind of like the backroom grease ball that was channeling directives from Klaus to fucking Le Petit Tart.
I believe Gerald Butts is like number five within the Open Society group. And Gerald Butts, when he left federal office, when he was working for Trudeau and the whole SNC-Lavalin scandal came out and he obstructed justice and everything else, he went to work for a New York firm. And that New York firm, I believe just, I think it was 6 months ago, scored something like a $287 million contract from the Alberta government. I can't remember.
Oh, no doubt. Those folks are like so interconnected with one another. It's
you know what
if, is you go back to it, was it not Henry Ford who said that if the average population understood the connections that were going on behind the scenes and how it ever I'm pretty sure it was Ford. Like this goes back like 100 years.
Ford said it was Jews that run the bank.
we're not allowed to use the J word or we get fucking yeah.
Exactly. No, it was George.
Bush. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it was George Bush who did an interview. George Bush Senior, and George Bush Senior did an interview, and he said to the woman, I think it was a New American magazine or something like that. And I quote, "If the American people ever found out what we were doing to them, they'd run
revolution by morning."
They chase us down the street and lynch us. And reality... Okay,
chase down the street and lynch us, but no, the one I heard was there would be a revolution by morning, but that quote was attributed to fucking Henry Ford. So you got to figure, like, that goes back a 100 years ago. But when said that was after the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank to try, you know, where he's basically saying, like, yeah, well, you know, blah. And, you know, there was like a couple, like very, very few handful of those elite American. And you know what? If you're American and you're like high upper brass, you probably know what's going on a broader scale, on a global scale. And if you're one of the few to like kind of like spit your tongue out about it and then disappear, you know what? It does create a, shall we say, an evidence trail that may not be perfect, but is still nevertheless one that lends itself towards making people question as to who really calls the shots. But, you know, one doesn't need to, shall I say, and for at very least for no other sake than my own personal safety, religiousify it. But, you know, there is... regardless of this or that or another particular category of individuals that we might be capable of defining in a very specific sense, it doesn't matter that as much as does the system that makes everything operate. Because without a system,
it doesn't matter.
Anybody in control may as well be, I don't know, that fucking little group in that island off of India that was like shooting bows a couple of years ago, and anybody who tried to like shoot, you know what I mean? Like, you may as well be that little fucking island shooting arrows at anybody coming near you if you don't have the system in place to rule the world. So, you know, anybody who has had, you know, dynamic that allows them to think that they need to be organized together, but not just organized together, but organized together in the sense that you need to dominate everything. I don't think that's religious. I don't think that's anything. What I think that is just, you know, the closest thing that, yeah, it's just, you know, power maniacs who don't give a fuck about humanity and just, you know, just want their own eternal life through, you know, the fourth industrial revolution, and think that the rest of the population is their means to get there. And whether it's even correct or not is irrelevant. What is relevant is making sure that the structural that might enable that doesn't exist. It's about deconstructing the capacity for a global ruling class to even exist. We'll just need to deconstruct the capacity for a global ruling class to exist. We need to deconstruct the capacity for a local ruling class to exist. And when I say local, I mean like, can I fucking walk there in a day? Nobody should have that type of power over me. Nobody should have that type of power over you.
And I think when you talk about the system, the best book to define the system is Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope.
Oh, man, I just got that on fucking Amazon like a couple months ago. I haven't had a chance to dive into it. But, I mean, I've looked at, like, segments of that over the years. And, yeah, I mean, he really kind of nails it down. Actually, he's got another one that is, I think, shall we say, almost a little bit more pertinent. And the Anglo-American establishment. Because if you really want to fucking take what Tragedy and Hope said, but narrow it down in terms of, like, you know, who deserves a fucking, you know, target on their fucking head.
I think if we really wanted to look at it, part of the problem is we lost when the Panama Papers weren't held accountable, and we didn't change our tax laws back then. And then if you look at the Lieber scandal. Basically said that every conspiracy theorist for the last 200 years was right, and that the banks glued together in order to set the rates to rip people off. So the one thing that's really
the institutions don't exist to hold them to account.
100%.
The only institutions that hold them to account are literally mass numbers of people going into their homes, dragging them fucking out, and, you know, holding them to account.
And the other thing is too, is that when we look at the banking system, most people feel they think that the banking system is nationalized, but what they don't understand that the Bank of Canada, hasn't followed the Bank of Canada Act for a while. So the Bank of Canada, its sole purpose is to set the interest rate and print the currency. We don't print the currency. That's printed by a private company based out of Germany and Austria.
There's a reason Rocco Galati never got anywhere with his lawsuit a decade ago. When he was working with doing the Comer lawsuit, C-O-M-E-R, Coalition of Monetary and Economic Reform, was an organization that Rocco Galati, who is currently, you know, despite health conditions that affected him last month, he is currently the leading constitutional lawyer trying to help Canadians against the Kung Flu drama. But a decade ago, he'd begun a lawsuit for the Coalition of Monetary and Economic Reform, Comer. Just look up Galati and Comer.
That's just it.
On the one hand, he fucked up. I will say he fucked up by literally trying to name anybody and everybody over the previous 40 fucking years as a defendant.
Defended.
That was a huge fuck up. It was like I mean, again, granted, the problem was is when he started it, and it wasn't his part. It was, I can't say it was his fault. It was more the organization's hiring him after the fact. I mean, the reality was, it was Pierre Ricardo, who was the Prime Minister of Canada, that oversaw the transition of how Canada financed every single public infrastructure from interest, zero interest Bank of Canada financing, and basically handed public infrastructure financing over to the private sector just around the time that the Nixon shock happened to have already occurred, and they knew that there was eventually going to be a giant interest rate spike and be able to put the Canadian public on the hook for a whole bunch of interest rate profit to the financial banking sector. I mean, you can't pretend that, Pierre Ricardo didn't have any idea what was going on.
Oh, he did. And then,
oh, he completely did. And so that was the problem. But the problem was is that when fucking, Gulati on Comer's behalf started trying to nail him, he was already dead. They're trying to nail other people. They're already dead. And so they kind of fucked up in terms of trying to like just create this like blanket list of defendants, half of whom are already fucking dead or out of office and irrelevant. Yeah. Instead of trying to go after just purely the government of Canada. When I started hearing in the last, month and a half about like, okay, is Gulati just kind of like, just trying to lead us down the wrong path and shit. It's like, I honestly think he needs to do well, but, he's got to be more targeted in terms of who he nails with his shit and who he goes after. Instead of just trying to say, hey, yeah, we're going to like this blanket swab, suit against anybody and everybody we could possibly even begin to connect to it. It creates a situation whereby a rational court is going to look at it and go, you're off the margins. Fuck you. I'm not going to parse through every single individual knowing that half of them are fucking dead. So it almost seems like if he agreed to Comer's ideas, that either he set them up to be fucking failed, or he didn't give them adequate advice in terms of who they could sue, which simultaneously shows a level of incompetence. But we also find ourselves as Canadians right now with him being the motherfucker who is in charge of the biggest constitutional lawsuit against the government right now. And if he was either as a incompetent as he appeared to be in the last one, or as overreaching as he was in the last one, then it doesn't figure well for us in his current stuff over the Kung Flu. So we need to try and find other alternative methods, at least from the legal system.
There isn't any.
Yeah, probably not. Like, no, the fact that he's challenged it on those levels in effect blocks us from high quality constitutional challenges. That I think, if he is, and I'm not going to say he is, but if he is an agent of the state, an agent of the globalists, if he is Yet he has created a, theoretically created, a false constitutional challenge, which will necessarily shut back a legitimate constitutional challenge, which will, you know, set back a real freedom movement that many, how many fucking years?
Almost like the convoy.
Well, the convoy. You know, oh, that's a like whole I get that. I get that. You know what? The convoy, I'll give it this. The 90-95% of the motherfuckers who marched on Ottawa to go in and stand up against tyranny, they're fucking hardcore. Those people deserve all our hugs, all our love, you know, all everything. But, you know, whether we start talking about this person or that person or that person or this person who happened to be the, you know, so-called leaders of the Canadian Revolution, it's kind of like, you know, one might want to question. One might want to question. One might want to question. You know what? There ain't no going to be a successful revolution in this day and age that is based upon such a small handful group of easily controlled, co-opted, captured so-called leaders. The only way the Canadian freedom situation will ever work is through a discoordinated 100% whack-a-mole type movement.
And how would that work?
Well, you know, hey, obviously I'm not anybody in charge, right? But what that really means is that, like, every community, whether it be in your local municipality, whether it be in a group of municipalities that are relatively near a border of international sorts of states, or near a, you know, port on the coast or whatever else, that, like, you know, we just slow things down and just become like a, you know, think about unions in terms of their, okay, we're not going on strike, but we're going to go work to rule. I guess that would be the best example I can give. It was just like, we're not going to go so far as to all of a sudden have, like, the government, like, step on our heads, rip everything away from us, and make, you know, like act like a bunch of totalitarian Chinese dictatorships. Because, you know what? If we force into that, you know, like, Trudeau's already proven that he's willing to be a Xi Jinping-style Chinese dictatorship. He does not care about democracy. He does not care about human rights. He wants power. He wants to ensure that his government has absolute control over the population. And you know what? Canadians aren't used to that level of totalitarian dictatorship. So many of us had stepped away once the measures got enforced. But this is why I say, is, you know, a slow roll as opposed to a full stop becomes more of the mechanism of basically trying to deliver a message, right? You know, where, like, all right, say we're, you and my hometown, I'm not even going to drop the name, but you and my hometown, say we go from, like, 220-something to 210-something. Slow as fuck. Just, like, crawl every step, right? And, you know, throw up a flag or two just so everybody knows why we're doing it. And, you know, by the point that the pigs start to begin showing up and say, okay, cool, yeah, and just all of a sudden hit the gas and start going the the regular lines, just enough to start slowing it down and reminding people that, hey, we're still enslaved, and there are still people who care about the fact that you're enslaved, and we don't want you to be enslaved anymore. So we're not able, you know, yeah, we're not willing to go to jail or have our equipment taken away in order to make this statement. We're just going to be a little bit of a pain in the ass here just to remind you that until you're fighting against this government, you're making all of us slaves.
And essentially, so that has to be done everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Everywhere, every country, every fucking city in Canada, every town, every municipality, every little hamlet. I don't care what the category of your local juridical government is. It doesn't matter. You need to sit there with your friends and the people that you know and the people that you trust and those that who believe in freedom and begin making sure that every day there's a slow roll. And that slow roll also means that, hey, you know what? And I honestly hate saying it. Because honestly, I think we deserve better than what is actually being put on offer. But as even a message of saying, like, hey, so yeah, we deserve way better options than what's being put forward on us. But just as a ways and means of saying, fuck you to Tardo, fuck you to, you know, like, I honestly think Pierre has been being groomed for this position for almost a decade. Literally, as soon as the Liberals, like, basically, like, parachute shit dropped fucking Letardo into the Liberal Party as a whatever, I swear, I have no proof of this, but I'd be willing to fucking bat my left nut if there was evidence to prove one way or the other, that fucking Pierre Poilievre was basically being groomed for the last almost decade to become the anti-Trudeau. Meaning the sense of, like, he's Trudeau's age, he's young, he's pretty, but he's got glasses, so he looks a little bit more intellectual. He's more articulate. They're feeding him the best lines to say about the economy, about society, about humanity, and they're literally been grooming him to become the anti-Tardo. Because Tardo was meant, before he even got into politics, to basically be shat onto the Canadian public as this little fucking pretty boy, to be marketable enough to sell globalist totalitarianism. But the fact is, one can only do that sort of thing for so long before it catches on to the public. And he eventually becomes unpopular. And I think he has reached his limit in terms of what his capability is of selling totalitarianism to the public has become. And if there was an election tomorrow, he would fucking lose. Which is why the grooming of Pierre Poilievre has been basically to effectively become the next Pierre, the next Justin X. No. The next Justin X Demared Letardo, only with a fucking blue ass wipe. He's the next Trudeau, only he's wearing fucking blue underwear. That's it. There's nothing else between them. Because he's better, he's smoother, he's more polished. You know, he wasn't just thrust into shit. They made him well. They made him a good talker.
Trudeau, the interesting thing about Pierre that's never brought up that I find interesting is that, one, Pierre's wife has got investment in a contract tracing company. Two, all the conservatives, if you listen to them, their talking points for the last 2 years have all been the same. It's all been about testing. So that tells me that they all have investment in testing companies. If we know Pierre did, then we know the rest of them all do.
Absolutely.
And about getting vaccines. In fact, for the first year and a half, when Trudeau was fumbling the vaccines, which I don't know if he was trying to save Canadians or
he wasn't. You can guarantee that.
Or
no. You got to think. In terms of the whole vaccine process, there has to do with everything from, you know, scaring people, which is media, to PCR tests, which is false positives, to convincing people into fucking cell vaccines. And you know what? Each different step along the way is going to require different companies with particular investments who are going to make particular profits upon each step of the way. So my suspicion is,
do you remember SARS?
Yeah, it went away within 6 months. But that was way more deadly than this shit.
Yeah, okay.
Allegedly.
Okay. So SARS, when SARS came around, that was when YouTube wasn't as censored as it is now. And the social media is way different than it is now, as the algorithms, they weren't completely in place to get more.
They couldn't control us as well back then.
Yeah.
It was just a scare tactic.
So when SARS came out, Council of Foreign Relations. Right. But the vaccine was what was causing the problem. So Council of Foreign Relations back then, they had a conference in which they talked about who won the information war, because there was a true war during that time. It was a battle between us, like you and me and all the people that were online and everything, and it was a battle between them. And it was following 9/11, and they tried to bring it in, and they admitted
defeat. Notice how that was before Facebook.
No, I think it was right at the beginning.
No, man. I think SARS was like early 2000s. Facebook hit about 06, 07. SARS hit a few years before. There was a different one.
Right, it was like on YouTube.
It was the swine flu that hit in about 2010, 2011. I'm sorry if I'm getting that wrong, but it was like Facebook had already jumped by the time that the quote-unquote swine flu hit. But the original SARS, you got to go. The original SARS was like, maybe you kind of got to go back to like fucking just post 9/11 shit. And they just didn't have the totalitarian infrastructure in place for them to do what they wanted to do back then.
I bet if we went back and looked at that, we would see that really was just a martial law drill. And it wasn't so much
9/11?
As...
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, no, actually. Think about this. Hold on, just wait. 9/11, what 9/11 was... was martial law, forget what you call it, what you want. What it really was an incident that established the foundational basis for governments in the world to put in place the erosion of civil liberties by way of creating a legal definition of terrorist that was not actually defined. It was a very, very vague word that no country dared to narrow the parameters down to. So what it basically enabled for a decade or decade later was anybody who disagreed with Trudeau to become a... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that SARS was 2000.
Go ahead, ask your question.
2004.
Sorry, shoot.
2003, 2004. 2002 to 2004.
Which was? Was SARS.
Yeah.
Yeah. So right SARS. After 9/11, when all of a sudden the word terrorism had been given a completely vague, inconclusive, indecisive, completely expansive definition that any government could use in order to find anybody who effectively disagreed with the government. Now, I'm gonna give you a little bit more issue about the SARS. Is that there have been dozens of Freedom of Information Act request in liberal democracies like Canada, Australia, United States, whatever, dozens of Freedom of Information Act requests about COVID-19, asking for, you know, basic, you know, okay, tell us what the, you know, the genetic code is for it, right? But if we go back prior to,
so 163 by Christina Matthews.
If we go back, yeah, exactly, Christine. We go back to 2019, 2020, you know, basically we're saying, like, okay, prove that this exists on paper. Because we know that the way you've defined COVID-19 is by taking a segment out of a SARS virus from 15 plus years ago and assuming that anything that anybody has, that, you know, if you do a CPR test and cycle it at 45 cycles instead of what the design process is of 25 cycles, that if you overcycle it to the point that you're almost guaranteed to create a false positive, that you will then find that one little segment of a 20-year-old SARS virus happens to exist, and you then end up justifying that this is a SARS COVID-19 case. Problem with that still, you go take it to the next step further, is not only is that it's a false positive of a case, and that false positive of a case then becomes a mainstream media statistic to then characterize and fearmonger to the general public, which we technically know. We technically know, and I could even find you the Minister of Health for fucking Manitoba stating the fact, because he was stupid enough to be honest in public, that, you know, it's like literally a 65% likelihood that using the PCR test is a false positive. So if we then eliminate all those cases, let alone, like, you know, how many of them are, you know, caused death or whatever, but, like, okay, now we're like a third related and whatever else. And then we go back further and go, okay, well, what were the typical on annual rates levels of people who died from influenza per year? There was really no distinction between 2019 and 2020 or 2018, 2020, 2021. There's really nothing. So, like, if one actually, and this is where they brainwash people, say, trust the science. It's like, yeah, actually, I do trust the science. What I don't trust is government propaganda. I can pull off all sorts of, like legitimate peer-reviewed journal studies that shows that whatever the hell our government's been trying to push is a load of crap. And so we got to keep that in mind in terms of people trying to say that we don't know what we're talking about. But then we have to understand and go, okay, well, why do they want to lie to us like that? You know, what's the purpose of the government trying to destroy our civil society over an issue that really doesn't exist in the way they represent it? It's like, what interests do they have? That's where you start got to draw your connections back to things like the World Economic Forum, things like the United Nations, you know, 2030 or 2021 agendas. You know, I mean, here's the thing, is like,
well, you can trace it back.
Most people, I'm gonna say this, and our moderator can legitimate this. He can legitimate me saying this from an academic standpoint. I am one of those people that most people would consider to be an academic Marxist. point being is that'll actually allows me to understand what the program in agenda is, how things are working, how are things are being cultivated step by step by step. Right? I'm not saying I advocate for it. I'm not saying that here's how I think should be. It's more like I wanted to understand how we were all getting fucked in the ass. And I figured out that this is like the best modality, the best technical academic comprehension of why we're experiencing what we're experiencing. So you can sit there and shit down my neck all you want and be like, oh, you're a fucking Marxist. I was like, no, man. I'm using this because that was like literally the chart that they fucking laid out. You want to know what's fucking going to happen? I can tell you one, two, three steps ahead of where we're already at right now. And
what's going to happen?
Dude, you think, James, that's the best fucking question you'd ask. Well, you know what? We've already seen it just today. The federal government stepped back from the emergency measures. But as we know, a week ago, what they stepped back from was goons at the border. They stepped back on goons on protesters because the protests they didn't care about. What they wanted was the excuse to begin establishing the technological infrastructure, from being able to say, hey, you don't agree with us, to we're going to basically pull all your finances. We're going to fucking starve you out if you don't do what we tell you. That is what they wanted to do, and they just... Go ahead.
In one essence, they're using the firing squad, historically speaking, at the end of the needle. And instead of lining up the intellectual class and the bourgeois, the intellectual class and bourgeois is lining up. Bourgeois is lining up to get the needle instead of in front of the firing squad, in order to keep acceptance. And then they go on.
There's the global bourgeois. There's the global bourgeois and there's the national bourgeois.
No, I don't.
The global bourgeois.
The unelected bureaucratic social engineers that would be the first to go, like in a revolution, the first thing they would take out.
Those are the global bourgeois. Those are the global bourgeois. And so they, at least the upper echelons of the bureaucracy, the upper echelons of the bureaucracy already knows that they're safe. And you know, the elected status politicians like Freeland and Letardo, they also know, they're like, you know, we had to get elected to get into the ability to do this, so we're gonna have to capitulate to the globalists if we want to make sure that the shot we get isn't the shot that kills. And that's my take on that.
The rest of the people, right? And
Why do you think they want to pull in 1.5% of our population each year now in terms of immigration? Because they realize, you know, I think somewhere I'd have to go and hunt for it, but I'm pretty sure that Gates said at one point, 10% of the population it goes because of, you know, vaccinations and this and that, whatever, right? So, okay, cool. 10% or a little bit more of our population fucking dies from vaccines, and all of a sudden Trudeau and fucking Freeland and shit like that want to bring like 1.4% by 2024. Like, you know, they're like, and here's the way I look at it is like, yes, we have technology that is going to replace labor, which is precisely the reason why we want to limit immigration. Because if we encourage immigration at the same time as we have technology that is going to diminish the amount of jobs that we need, then what we're doing is creating a situation that's going to drop fucking wages for all sorts of people, right? But nobody seems to be jumping on that. Doesn't matter if you're fucking... Well, it's fucking...
falling in line with the UN plan.
Yes, exactly. It's a clergy plan, if you want to be honest. But, you know, you think you're fucking... You think even fucking, you know, PPC and what's his name even want to fucking mention that? No. That's...
Did you just say the clergy?
Is that
what you just said?
Yeah, but the problem with the clergy plan is it was done on a the problem with the clergy plan is it was solely culture and nasis. It was solely culture in the way it fucking regarded itself. The problem is culture is actually a secondary focus. The primary focus is economic. They want to drive down the wages and turn our middle class into fucking serfs.
Into serfs. Yeah.
So the clergy plan,
and I think
is one of those. Hold on. The clergy plan is something that people want to disrepute people like us. Can then go and look back and say, oh, yeah, well, it was fucking conspiracy theory from like 80 years ago that said this and blah, blah, blah. But you know what? The reality is, it's not even that. Like, it's like the clergy plan has more to do with in terms of like mass importation of migrants. When what we really need is a population development system that is based upon import substitution. Basically, instead of bringing in people that are culturally incompatible, what we need to do is take real Canadians who have real Canadian values and create policies that encourage them to have more kids, like Poland is doing, or like Hungary is doing.
Well, that is... that fault, you kind of hit it on the nail on the head. In order to understand where we are today, like you touched on it for class warfare. We'll probably wrap up here because I'm starving.
But is class being carried out through cultural warfare? And that's the point. Is like,
well,
we are experiencing class warfare being conducted through cultural warfare, and so. We can't just ignore the cultural warfare aspect. We need to find a technical, shall we call it, policy mechanism that can A, counter the cultural warfare, but B, also be cultivated in such a way as to give the working class a better foothold for itself against the globalists.
Okay, well, I got one thing, and this will be my last note. Do you not think that the resounding message, you talk about cultural, do you not think that the resounding message from the convoy and all the people who attended it, that was the cultural message? Is that
the cultural Canada- message was, the cultural message of the convoy was that the totalitarian globalist state does not give a fuck about human rights. It does not give a rat's ass about the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It will use those, not all of, because there were some of who stepped away, but those members of the military and the police force who don't care about the oaths that they gave when they took their job, but prefer to conduct their activities based upon whatever the hell they're told and follow orders like Nazis. That my point is what has been taught to us as Canadians as a consequence of the convoys is that we do not any longer live in a democratic society. We do not in any way live in a liberal society, that we actually are subjugated to goons who care more about their short-term and intermediate income situations, to the point that they will disobey their oaths in order to follow governments that disobey their constitutions. We are still, regardless of whatever might have been announced today, we are still in a state of occupation by globalists who have insidiously taken control of our federal government, and us not having an effective mechanism within our government to contradict globalist insidious sorts of infiltration. We weren't prepared for what the globalists did. And so as a consequence, our military, state, and police apparatus have just allowed themselves to be subordinated rather than do what they ought to do by law, by the charter, by the Constitution, and rise up and take people like Trudeau and Freeland and any fucking asshole who's associated with them, subjugate them, put them parcelized into completely separated sorts of, like, you know, prison cells, and then allow the rest of Canada to be able to have a vote on what a real and free democratic liberal society should be. I don't know. Does that make sense? Or did I rant too much? I'm sorry, bro.
That's all right. This whole thing has been awesome. I've enjoyed this conversation.
Motherfucker, I told you I was going to be here for 15 minutes, and you dragged me up for 2 hours. Love you, brother.
That's all right. It'll be recorded. I'll drop it on my channel, and you can have it, and people will be able to view it. And I appreciate you coming up. We'll have you on more, and I'll be doing this more. I just wanted the conversation, and I know you have a background in labor studies, and you, and I know your background, right? And I think that at times,
some people might agree, some people might not, and I don't respect everybody too. My whole point is like, okay, here's an asshole who, and this is the way I've always kind of looked at it, is like, on the one hand, I'm, you know, philosophically right, but on the other hand, I also kind of got, like, at least to a certain proportionate degree, technical understanding of why certain aspects on the left have a valid utility. Trying to articulate that nuanced difference is very hard to come by. And so I really do appreciate the fact that you give my insane ass a chance to articulate that shit.
No worries, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you talking, and I appreciate what you had to say. I hopefully you'll take time and listen to it. There was a lot discussed, man. We discussed a lot of shit. Like labor laws and class laws, yeah, and how we got
me
here.
And you, me and you another day on the private setting, we gotta discuss, like, fucking, you know, future alternatives and start working on shit. So that's a whole other conversation, but not necessarily one for the whole crew, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm innocent. Recording it, I'm innocent, but we have to discuss a lot of shit. I think you know what? I think our country has a lot of choices to make, and it's not just, you know, it's not something that anybody can force it's anybody to make. I think just
it's not left or right. It's not fucking this or that. It's when I look at it, it's
Canada.
Yeah, we do. It's like, do we want to be like, I don't know, Ceausescu's Romania under Trudeau? Or do we want to be like, you know, a country where, as a civilian, we actually have some sort of meaningful input into what we experience as a citizen?
Or what we grew up with as kids, because we grew up free. We really did. We might actually be the last generation to experience freedom on this planet. And on that
Gen X, motherfucker.
That, you know, that's an alarming thought, that Gen X might be the last free generation to grow up as kids, and it's kind of looking that way if we don't do anything. And that's really what it boils down to.
And the fact that we need to do anything, the fact that Gen X has to be the fucking generation that, like, literally takes, like, Gen Y or the fuck they are, slap in the face, like, repeatedly, like a bunch of fucking stupid hookers, and be like, hey, fucking snap out of this. Stop watching your fucking TV, get your ass off your fucking phone, and start worrying about making sure that the people that you know are A, care about, B, fed, C, you know, got fucking, you know, access, the ability to improve your own self. Rather than just being, you know, a slowly dying fucking segment of the population, right? Like, you know, and I look at that and I go, and this is where it becomes, is like, you look at all these like sheep and shit, right? Like, yeah, okay, don't be provided food, but what the fuck food are they being provided? Genetically modified? Non-beef, yeah, genetically modified non-beef, yeah, but they're being brainwashed for decades in terms of like, oh, we gotta be like so environmentally progressive. We can't eat beef. We can't eat salmon. We can't eat, you know, whatever. And we can only eat fucking, you know, like literally genetically modified soy. And that's why they haven't figured it out that we call them fucking soy boys. It's like you literally, these motherfuckers are literally programming themselves. Well, not programming themselves, they've been programmed, but they're accepting and continuing and forwarding the programming of themselves into literally becoming nothing more than unhealthy, inorganic, genetically modified, you know, pieces of toxic sludge. And, you know, hey, fine, if you're all just willing to do that for yourselves, fine, no big deal, whatever. You want to fucking jump off a cliff, that's your fucking problem. But the problem is that these assholes get to vote. That's my concern, is the motherfuckers who think that, like, living that sort of way ought to entitle them to have a vote over how people who want to eat real food interact between each other as a normal human has historically for the last, I don't know how many thousands of years, interacted. And, you know, that these people want to try and, like, influence us. It's like, no. Like, by all means, go vote for yourself on the coast. On the coast. You can have all the coast. Seriously, go have the coast. Coast is all yours. vote for your like digital slavery for amongst yourself, but literally let us allow ourselves to drive ourselves a line geographically where your lifestyle bullshit doesn't impact on us, and we can literally live like organic beings where, you know, hey, you know, the these eggs I consume are...
I think that place is called Montana.
Yeah, I know, man. Montana and Idaho are like literally the last refuges of like human living, I swear.
I wouldn't go to Florida because it's Florida. Just because the DeSantis there doesn't mean it's any better. It's still shit hole and always was. But I'd go to Montana. I would go live on the Rockies. But I'm gonna get dinner, man. I really appreciate you doing this, buddy. We'll do this again.
Hey, I will say this though. Before we go, I think Florida's got a little bit more than you might give them credit for. But yeah, definitely Montana, Idaho, a little bit better above them. I give Florida a lot more credit than I would places like Washington State, Oregon, Southern California, a bunch of other, New York Jews, whatever, like all of those places where they just fucking give them a chance to like run free. Like, I wouldn't personally want to like be all like, you know, you're going and doing like breaststroke swimming and places that got like gators and shit. That's not really my thing, but you know, hey man, those motherfuckers might make some good boots, you know. I still trust them more than I do fucking John Horgan Texas. Here in BC,
Texas.
And, you know, John Horgan in BC, I trust that son of a bitch as much as...
I wouldn't trust any of them.
Yeah, I would have cut my mouth off before I get arrested. All right, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, dude. Talk to you later. Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers. And that was a crazy rant. I hope you all enjoyed it. And I'll drop the recording down. And basically just a conversation. And I just wanted people to hear a different point of view, different perspective, maybe some history. All right. Have a good night, folks. Hope you enjoyed it.